You are listening to Right Back At Ya, the 2000s pop music podcast where we have fun taking pop music seriously. Hosted by, he's a trouser enthusiast who loves to play hide and seek, David Lim. And me, I'm ready for an everlasting night in a brave new world. Just call me Thriller Joel Babington. Hello, David. How are you doing?
JB, very great start to the week here. Very excited with this episode that we've got.
Absolutely. We have a hugely esteemed guest with us. Let's give them their intro.
We are joined today by Ian Masterson, a prolific pop songwriter, producer, composer, remixer, who has worked with so many of our favorite pop girlies. Think Dani Minogue, Jerry Halliwell, Sophia Lis-Bextor, Girls Aloud, Kylie, Bananarama, and Pet Shop Boys. You know, not a pop girly, but adjacent to the world of pop girlies.
We'll call them.
Now, Ian was also part of the electronic dance production duo Trouser Enthusiasts, which were called Flexi Finger before that, or Flexi Fingers. I mean, these names are just blowing my mind. We'll have to get into that in a sec. And also Thriller Jill, which is another alias. You might recall seeing these names credited on countless remixes that we know and love from the 90s, 2000s and onwards. Now, Ian's credits in the world of TV, live events and concert production is probably even longer. He is the music producer on Strictly Come Dancing for 8 years and counting, something like that. And RuPaul's Drag Race UK, he has scored many hit comedy series, including Ab Fab, Beautiful People, The Windsors, as well as over 30 documentaries for the BBC, ITV, Channel 4, Sky. We're extremely grateful, not just for his talents and contributions to the 2000s pop world, but also for his time with us today. So please welcome to the show, Ian Masterson.
Woo! Hello, Ian. How are you doing?
Oh, good, thank you. I'm not quite sure I recognise that person. What a lovely intro. Thank you.
No, thank you so much for...
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us today, Ian. We are so excited to get into it. You know, here we spread the good word of pop, and like our audience love, especially when we get to go behind the scenes, behind this music that has soundtracked our lives. And today we're going to be talking to you about some of the legendary artists you've worked with along the years. Also, maybe you can give me some tips on Strictly a bit later on, but we'll see how we get on. But before all of that, Ian, please can we go right back to the beginning of your music journey? How did you get started in music? How did your music journey begin?
Well, I was always a kind of geeky kid who liked playing with keyboards and recording equipment at home. And I knew I was always sort of really interested in music production. And my parents were pretty supportive of that. And I never really thought I could do it sort of professionally. But so I went to university and didn't do anything to do with music. But while I was there, I was still writing songs and working on sort of dance tracks and stuff. And then my last year at university, I vaguely knew someone who had an agent in London. So I basically went to see them and played them some songs I'd written. And literally, so they sort of said, well, Steve Allen at Warner's is looking for tracks for Dani Minogue's new album. These might be the kind of songs they're looking for. And so I went to see Steve Allen, and literally the next day I was in the studio with Dani.
Oh my God.
A couple of them. So it was a bit of a sliding doors, lucky break, you had to be there kind of moment, really. And that, I haven't really looked back since, really. That's where it all kind of started.
Starting with Dani Minogue is pretty epic.
Yeah, like what a way to begin.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, I think it's definitely a very unusual place to start with, you know, an artist that big as basically your first sort of professional production project when you hadn't really done very much stuff before. But I think, you know, Steve was one of the sort of old school A&R people who just really believed in the right vibe for a song, the right artist, looking after artists with, and putting with producers who he felt they could sort of, you know, would be understood by. So that's how it kind of came around.
And tell us about what you remember of that first day, that first session?
I didn't have that much experience of working in big studios. And I remember it was, where was it? I think it was The Matrix in the center of town, which is long, long since gone now. But I remember obviously being quite nervous, and I was sitting in the kind of little producer's lounge watching TV. And it was actually, I think the Spice Girls Wannabe had just been released.
Oh, wow.
And Danny came in, and we both sort of said hi to each other, and we were watching it. And she's like, I think they're going to be amazing. And so we both sort of clicked. And, you know, then we just went to the studio and we just started throwing ideas around. And her friend Terry Ronald, who's now obviously one of our sort of closest mates as well, he was there with her to sort of help sort of the vocal production side, mm-hmm. which is a good job because I had literally no idea what I was doing. And so we, you know, became sort of firm friends, and we did sort of a few tracks for that album.
And this is the Girl album that we're talking about, which is the beginning of your journey there with Danny.
Mm. The first track we did was called Someone New, and then...
Crazy track. Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. The Flexi Fingers remix was is on the album, isn't it? That is a crazy rave song.
Yeah, that was sort of the first one I kind of did.
Look, Joel and I talk about our Danny kind of immersion quite often. And, you know, for us, the 2000s Pop Music Podcast, we really started talking about Danny's music from the Girl album, actually, mm-hmm. because we feel like that was when she really came into her own artistically. And she was in this dance pop world that no one was doing it the way she was doing it. I mean, that was Madonna, but I think the clubbier sound that she was going for in Girl was really ahead of its time. One of our favorites actually is Disremembrance, which you worked on as well. What are your memories of that song and that time?
Well, we'd done Someone New, and then basically, because we got on so well, I said, well, we'll try writing a few more. And I was working with a guy, a friend of mine from school called David Green at the time. And we were writing songs, and one of them, was Disremembrance, basically. And he'd written a lyric for it, and I wrote the melody. And I did a very, very, very bad rough demo of me singing it. And Terry and Danny liked it enough to help shape it into what you can kind of hear on the record. By then, I was sort of completely intoxicated with the whole being a record producer production side of it. So I asked if we could have an orchestra on the track. Well, you know, in complete naivety that these things cost, you know, £25,000. And, you know, Warner said yes.
Oh, my God.
So I ended up doing my first orchestral recording session.
Wow.
For that, which was incredible. And then having this beast of a record with all this huge orchestra and all these huge synths and backing vocals and everything else to try and mix, and being completely out of my depth. So it probably took me about a month to finish it.
Oh, my God. I mean, that is a masterpiece. And I remember reading that you're a Pet Shop Boys fan.
Yeah.
In the early days. And that really, that kind of blend of the orchestral strings and the synths, you're kind of taking Danny into PSB world there.
Yeah, I think very much that was, you know, that's always been the kind of style of music I really love, is slightly sort of epic, I'd say emotive, grandiose, kind of disco-y influenced pop.
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of that in your discography that we'll get to.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of that in the discography. You can't do anything else, basically. That's
I love the
saying.
Drama.
That's all we
I
want.
Love a
that's all we want.
We love an emotional, dramatic strings with, like, just clubby beats. Like, that is a bit of me.
Yeah. Okay, good.
So then, as well as Danny being your first ever sessions, in the way of, like, music releasing and everything, was that also the first, like, release that you had?
Yeah, I think around the same time it started to do the sort of Trials Enthusiast remixes as well, because that sort of, I guess, started 97. Yeah, by around 97, I think. And so that was kind of kicking off at the same time.
Wow.
Doing bits of pop music and doing then getting into doing a lot of dance music as well.
So that's why Danny's like the perfect artist for that at this time.
Yeah, really. And, you know, I did a lot of the same time that sort of her album was being finished, Trials Enthusiast had ramped up to the point where our mixes were being very successful. And so we sort of did quite a few for her album as well on the Xenomania tracks and my own as well. So it was a very sort of very busy, productive time then. And also looking after all of her kind of live performances, putting them together and doing the production for that. So, we spend a lot of time with each other at that period of time.
Amazing. It's almost like, you know, you're going for it, like pursuing your dreams. And then in first session, you get like not only one, but two then great creative partners and friends in Danny and Terry. Like,
yeah.
Amazing first day at work ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But you're talking about live production there. We on this podcast often talk about like if we could strap ourselves into the time machine where we would go. Danny did the 98 Unleashed tour. Were you involved in that? Were you doing production on that?
Yeah, I did all of that. Yeah. So I was the MD.
Oh my God. And then was that your first time MDing as well?
Well, we've done quite a few one-off shows before that because it was a busy time for promo for her. But it was the first time we put a kind of a full live tour together. It was really great to sort of get out there and see her do an entire show together. And it wasn't like a fully, not an enormous sort of stage production kind of tour. It was very much a band, theatre style. And I guess sort of quite gritty and up close with the fans and everything, and it was just really fun because of that, you know.
Do you have kind of any standout memories at all or like in general from that tour?
Meeting my husband.
Oh, that's a pretty
good one.
You've
got to tell us the story.
Yeah. So the last day of the tour, actually, we did an extra a bonus gig after the last show in a gay club in Cardiff, and he was in the audience.
Oh my God.
And that's when we met, and we've been together ever since.
Oh my God. Thank God for Danny.
Yeah. So first big artist you're working with, good friend in Danny, good friend in Terry, and then now future husband as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible.
Gift that keeps on giving.
It's sickening, isn't it, really?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's what we love to hear. I feel like when, and this is another reason why Danny is then perfect to be hosting I Kissed a Boy, I Kissed a Girl. Like, I feel like when she was being approached for that, or if she was involved in it earlier on, her tagline should have just been your story of meeting your husband, and that is why she should be hosting this show.
That's basically why I insisted on writing the theme music for that show when I found out she was doing it, because, you know, she's the original gay Cupid for me. And the song's lyrics are all basically about that period when I met my husband Dan, and, you know, that whole kind of vibe. And weirdly, my husband, Dan, is like, he's a big fan of your pod.
Dan.
I'm really not a kind of a big podcast person and listen to a lot of them, but he's, sort of that period of pop music is his thing. And he was like, you've got to get in touch with these guys. You know, we've got to, you know, this is a podcast. You definitely should be on. They're right up your street. They're lovely and they're really funny. And I was like, okay, yeah. So,
oh my God. Well, hello, Dan. So the pressure is on now, David.
Yeah, no biggie.
Well, that's so wonderful to hear. I mean, skipping forward a million years, thank you for getting Danny back in the studio for the theme song. I mean, it had to be. She had to be doing the theme song for that show, you know?
Well, that's what I thought too.
All right. Well, shall we go back and talk about some Neon Knight stuff, Devo?
Yeah. I mean, look, I want to start with an Instagram post that you put up, Ian, and...
Oh, dear.
I was trolling on your Instagram. Fabulous photo of you, bleach blonde hair. And I think Danny must have been in, like, put the needle on it era with a really sexy grungy mullet. Mm. What a fun throwback snap. What was your feeling with entering the Neon Knights era with her? You know, having done something so successful already in sort of 97, 98 period, but this is like a whole new chapter.
Yeah, and it came about through Who Do You Love Now? Because basically London approached Danny to do the vocals on that, the instrumental of that track. And she basically brought me and Terry in with her as part of, look, I have to do the vocals with these guys because this is what makes me comfortable. And thankfully, you know, that went really well. And Phil Faversham, who's the A&R guy at London, who's putting that together at the time, and we just really clicked and we all got on really well, had a really good laugh. And he's like, well, look, we want to do a whole album. And do you guys want to write some stuff? And, you know, there are other people we knew who were doing it. And we sort of spent, I think, about 18 months doing that.
Wow.
Doing various tracks for that. And he was really great because he was kind of a visionary in a way, in the same way that Steve Allen had sort of brought that dance sound into pop through her Girl album. He sort of got this whole kind of fusion of electropop, 80s,
yeah,
French house,
yeah,
and kind of stuff that hadn't been heard. And obviously, you know, everyone's doing kind of 80s referencing pop music.
And people were doing that kind of disco sound in the early 2000s. But by the time this record came, it shifted into something a little grittier. Like the beats were a little bit crunchier, a little bit more lo-fi.
Yeah.
And no one was doing it like that.
Yeah, and it was very much a sort of a nod to records that he loved and we loved. So we all got on really well. And I think there's a real sort of cohesive sound to that album because he was great at putting it together.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, because listening to it, it sounds like there was such a clear brief. Were you guys all working towards that or did it navigate towards that?
Any brief, I think, on an album develops as you sort of progress through it. And Danny was very much involved in the writing and production herself. So as new sounds and ideas were presented, you know, I'd go off and do a sort of backing track of, like, you know, just playing around sort of bleepy things, and that, you know, became Mystified. And that was one sort of direction for the album quite early on. And then there's sort of cut-up disco-y sort of sample-y thing became part of it as well. And I don't know, there's just a kind of a really cool fusion between a lot of different styles there, but it all seems to hang together, which is great, I think.
Still to this day, right, I'll have people and I'll put on that Danny album and they will still be so in, like, A, it was really huge, but also people are still discovering it to this day. They're still like, oh my God, this album is incredible because it is all killer, no filler, can keep absolutely cohesive body of work. Do you have any standouts, Ian, on the tracks you worked on?
Oh, no, I mean, I just love the whole album. I'm lucky enough to have a sort of gold disc of it in the studio, and I just love looking at the artwork and reminding me of that whole period. And I'm very proud of a lot of the stuff we did around that album, the B-sides and stuff as well.
Oh, yeah. Goodbye Song, Hide and Seek.
Yeah.
Oh, I was obsessed with those two B-sides.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, Goodbye Song, I think I've always been slightly gutted that didn't make it onto the album, actually, because I really love that track. And it's so weird. But yeah, I mean, I just love that whole period. So it's great to have been part of that.
Keeping with Danny, but jumping around in your career, and then, you know, you start doing all this stuff in the TV world, and then not only killing it in pop and remixing, but then you start killing it as a composer, and then you work on one of the best comedies from the BBC in the 2000s, Beautiful People. And that gives us the opportunity for you to be, you know, one of the only people to bring Danielle Jane and Kylie Ann Minogue on a track together with an ABBA cover. I mean, if that's not gay rights, we don't know what is.
Yeah.
Well, A, how did Beautiful People come about as a whole? And then how did that duet come together?
Well, Beautiful People was being produced by a friend of mine called Justin Davies, who's an Aussie. And he was also a Danny fan. And he said, oh, we're doing this show. I'd really like you to come in and chat to our exec producer and writer, Jonathan Harvey and John Plyman, about maybe doing some music for the show, see how you guys get on, if you want to do it. And I'd never scored a comedy show before. But I really liked the idea of what they, because they were talking about doing sort of musical numbers and stuff in it. And I, of course, I really loved the idea of that. And so we all just hit it off and I started doing it, and it became something that I ended up, you know, putting a lot into. And one of those things was suggesting, look, I really think for this moment in this episode, we could do Winner Takes It All. And how about I ask Danny and Kylie to do it together?
And were producers' jaws on the floor when you just say that, or?
Yeah. And I just, and again, it was me getting overexcited. I mean, you know.
Oh, we know
all
about
the things
that
you could ask them to do. Yeah. And I basically just steamrolled everyone into doing it. That's basically what happened.
MBA, OBA, like knighthood. Let's make it happen.
Well, just, you know, it's, people know what I'm like and they're like, oh, God, let's just do it. Shut him up. So. So that's really what happened. And it's just, you know, because they're mates and it just seemed like a nice thing to do. And it wasn't really a big pressure thing. It wasn't going to be a, you know, a single. It wasn't going to be like, you know, part of either of their album campaigns. It was just something to do for a fun show that had a very ahead of its time and rather beautiful message about young queer identity mm-hmm. and growing up. And obviously a huge love of pop music. So,
yeah.
You know, they were both very kind in agreeing to do it, and then proceeded to basically smash the fuck out of it, so it sounds incredible.
So it's you, Steve Anderson, and Terry Ronald producing.
Mm. Yeah.
Kylie and Danny singing. You have the, is it the BBC Royal Orchestra?
BBC Concert Orchestra.
BBC Concert Orchestra. And, you know, anyone that knows anything about pop music is that ABBA songs are actually really hard. They give two powerhouse vocals on it. Just, you know, it, there's nothing done by halves on this track.
No, there never is, really. That's the thing.
And it's ABBA, so you gotta, you know, go all out for ABBA, especially. So I can't even imagine how this ask came about. Like, Ian, did you get on the speakerphone to both of them? Was it an email thread? Fax?
I can't remember. I can't remember. I tend to present these things as like, oh, yeah, guess what we're doing now?
Oh, it's kind of like,
so it's just come along for the ride.
Ladies, we're doing it.
Yeah.
I'll see you in the studio tomorrow.
Addison Lee's book.
I think it might have been that I reached out to Steve. He'll probably have a better memory of this. And said, do you think Kylie be up for this as well?
Yeah. Tag team.
Because we're kind of, you know, Steve's basically like my sort of musical twin brother, really.
Mm.
Obviously, we've worked in very similar areas, and each for a Minogue.
Yeah, so you're in the monogamous world. Yeah.
So you know, that kind of thing. We, when it's me and him and Terry, it's a bit of a sort of a powerhouse for those poor girls. Really, they can't. You know, they didn't get away from saying no.
How could they?
Yeah, absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. And obviously, before we go a bit later on, we want to hear about what you guys are teaming up on now, but we will get to that. So before we leave Danny Ian, we have to talk about 2015. Legendary moment in pop music, but especially for like a Danny Minogue fan. this Danny 15-minute set for Mardi Gras. I can't believe it was already 10 years ago. And you, in 15 minutes, managed to give us Daniel Jane the Eras Tour.
Well, yeah, I didn't think of it. Well, yes. Very, very miniaturized version, yeah, I guess. We just put together a show that we thought would be very different and very stylized and be a kind of huge sort of DJ mashup mega mix of a lot of things, and dropping in a few surprises.
The tidbits in there, the way certain songs are mixed in, the Disremembrance, which, you know, obviously we love. I was losing my mind. There's every moment of that set was gold. I just, sometimes, you know, when we're having a bad day, we're just like, just put on that performance. And I think, Joel, were you with me when she did it in London? Because she did like a replica of that set.
Beating myself up to this time. I think it was just before we lived together. Yeah.
And you were there too, Ian. Yeah, I assume you were doing that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And you put in Love Fight for that one.
Yes, we did. Yeah,
oh my God, lost my mind. Like, my mind never came back after that moment. Yeah. Sorry, I have to deal with this now, but yeah.
Yeah.
Were there any songs in that set list that you were like, Danny, I think we should really do this? And she was like, not so sure. Was there something that you fought for? You love fought for?
No, I mean, we've very much a kind of a very shared sensibility of what feels right to do, I think, at any particular time. And we are very much a hive mind, me and her and Terry, about, we all agree on certain things and when something feels instinctually right, and everyone brings different ideas to the table. And to be honest, we probably just sort of sat and had a couple of glasses of wine, had a laugh and thought, this will be fun. Why don't we do that? And then before you know it, it's on stage.
I love that. Absolutely.
That's how this podcast started. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Shall we move on to another artiste? Jerry Halliwell.
Oh my gosh.
Ian, you worked a lot with Al Jerry during the Passions album. But your journey with Jerry started a little bit earlier. You did a Brave New World B-side for the second album, and you did a Trouser Enthusiasts remix of Bag It Up as well. Do you remember sort of your way starting working with Jerry?
Chris Briggs, her A&R guy, he's another brilliant A&R guy, EMI. I think it was Matt Waterhouse, who did her club promo, got me to do some mixes for her. And then Chris really liked the vibe of them. And we just started chatting about doing stuff. And I think he gave me sort of additional production duties on Brave New World. And then on Ride It, basically, I think. I think that's how it started. And then another track I can't remember the name of. But then Jerry heard it. She really liked it. And she was going to the studio. And sort of it was a kind of, I suppose, like an auditioning process, actually working with her in the studio. Turned up at the studio and we started writing, and it was with Hannah Robinson.
Lovely Hannah.
Who I'd been writing stuff with and who's amazing. And we just did a lot of sessions, really, trying ideas out. And
there were lots of ideas. So many ideas. I mean, I like to think now, Ian, in your era of working on Strictly, that maybe the Passions album and those sessions was what set you up for the kind of variety, because Ride It, we've got a bit of tango, and then there's always Tomorrow, a bit of bossa nova, Love Never Loved Me, which is one of my favorite songs of all time, truly one of my favorites of all time.
Oh, thank you.
It's dramatic, as we said before, we love dramatic, we love strings, we love crying at the disco, and you really gave us with that. I mean, the range on this album, what was it like to go into a studio with a creative like Jerry, who is, I imagine it's kind of she's got different ideas, and it's, you know, sometimes they don't all fit together, but it could also be a fun challenge. You never know what sounds you're going for, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, what I try and do is always prep ideas before we go into a studio with any artist based on what, on researching what they like and what I think will kind of, well, I think they've always sounded best on, and therefore, you know, you get the kind of best performance from, you know, hopefully get the best song out of. So I've always got a lot of ideas to sort of bring to the table to see, you know, to play. How about something like this? How about something like that?
Yeah.
You know? Definitely with Jerry, there would have been some Latin-influenced ideas on the table because I know she really liked, you know Machico Latina,
exactly,
and all that
kind
of stuff. She's always, you know, a lot of the Spice Girls had that influence. Something like Love Never Loved Me would be me sort of trying to steer her into an area which Hannah and I would have really more identified with, which is kind of slightly, I've always sort of called it like a French disco sound, where it's a little bit...
mon amour.
Yeah, exactly. And you get, like, literally that track, I think, starts with the sound of rain, because I always see it as a sort of dark French rainy street, yeah, with a sort of pulsing electronic bass line. So that would have come from me.
David's one of the biggest advocates, and I completely agree that Love Never Loved Me should have been a single. You know, what a perfect follow-up to Ride It would have been.
Yeah, I think so. One of the strengths of Jerry, I mean, she is a powerhouse and always was a powerhouse of completely left field, but very, you know, creative ideas, you know, 50% of which may never have made it onto a record. But she'd always come in with something, or she'd have heard something, or she was like a sponge. She just absorbed ideas, so that, you know, it was you never kind of knew what you were going to get, and there'd be some handbrake turns on something you'd be working on, because then suddenly her eye would get caught by something else. You'd have to go down a different tangent altogether. So it was definitely an eye opening period of time, and definitely, I think it definitely gave me a lot of experience as a producer, just in terms of, I guess, working with someone who's not in the kind of traditional industry box of a very, you know, an artist who's been given an A&R brief and then sent out to a load of producers who fit that A&R brief. It's more like, and this is what Chris Briggs was really good about, he could find people that she knew she would feel safe and comfortable with.
Mm.
And then see if you could actually get at something that really connected her to the song.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, her best stuff is all, you know, with the Spice Girls and Outside, has always been where you could hear Jerry's personality come through. So, it was, I wouldn't say it was a particularly easy period of time, because, you know, you've got a major, major star who's quite a complicated personality. And There were a lot of high points and a lot of low points. I think that's the best way to put it.
Mm.
I mean, to us as pop fans, like, you and Hannah deserve contribution from Music Award for Love Never Loved Me in and of itself. and yeah, I mean, we had the honor of, like, chatting to Hannah last year, and she was so wonderful. Mm. And yeah, she told us some great Jerry stories. So we got a little taste of maybe how that sessions all were. I mean, anyone that listens to this pod, I think I Want the Whopper, Fuck the Big Mac lives rent free in our minds. We're still waiting for 2025 version. But there is so much lore to pop fans of, like, how this album kind of went on a journey. And even you discussing it, you can understand that, yeah, maybe if Jerry has so many different creative ideas and it goes down so many journeys, and then, you know, if that's a 6 months, a year, year and a half, 2 years, down there is more curation. But, like, Spice Girl fans love to talk about, allegedly it was going to be called Disco Sister originally, and Hannah recalled recording a song called Disco Sister Music. Do you recall anything from those earlier sessions that were leading down towards that more disco-y sound?
No, I think it was one of those songs. I think that came from a backing track I did. And to be honest, I think it's one of my favourite things we did with her. And I'm not sure why I never got used. It's actually really good.
Oh, my God.
It's really good in that of that time. You can imagine it being a really great Cherry single. So, yeah, it's funny you should mention that. Yeah, and it never really saw the light of day because I think stylistically then things had moved on. But it was very, very bright and breezy disco.
Wow.
Very kind of ballsy, fun track. So,
wow.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Listen, Ian, I mean, you've got your hands in many different TV avenues. Keep that track in mind if there's ever an opportunity to pitch it.
Well, that would be up to Jerry, I think.
Oh, okay. Right. I mean, you know, maybe it's that thing of like what you did before. Is that, right, we're doing this. The offer's on the table. Jerry, yes, no, yes. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. I'll take that as a yes.
Ian, I'll tell you what I told Hannah with an unreleased Frankie from S Club Juniors in the Saturday song. We are available to record it.
Okay.
The Disco Brothers.
There was, Jerry had announced this tour at the time that unfortunately never went ahead, but do you think you would have been involved in that if it had happened?
Yeah, I imagine so, yeah. I did sort of production on quite a few of her, like when she did GAY. So I put show together for her. Oh, actually, do you remember the Brits Awards show where she came out with the legs?
Yes.
So the voice at the start of that, which goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Jerry Halliwell," that's me.
Oh!
Wow. Ian, that is a claim to fame. Why isn't that top line on your website? Isn't that,
there you go. How about that for a clanging name drop?
Oh, my God. So then did you do production on that whole Bag It Up number?
No, I mean, that was largely the original track. I can remember doing intros and stuff for it. But around that period of time, I was doing quite a lot of those sort of GAY shows for various artists because... I think it was in there every other weekend.
Yeah.
Really.
Oh, what a time.
Because every pop artist was kind of wanting to launch something spectacular at GAY. You know, Jeremy creates such an amazing venue for enabling that, where you could do a kind of sort of a theatre show with, you know, sets and lighting and or a band or dancers, because it's a huge stage and it always felt like such an amazing event. And, you know, the press would be all over it. And it was such a great time for those kind of... And the record companies obviously had budgets, obviously didn't have anymore. But you could do these incredible one-off shows. And I used to love doing those, you know, creating sort of dramatic intros and, you know, stitching songs together, which is, you know, largely, I think, gave me the skill set now to work on Strictly. It's very much that kind of, you know... the same sort of sensibility of creating theatrical moments, I guess.
Do you have any sort of GAY sets that you worked on at the time that stand out as favourites?
Well, Danny's sets were always great. You know, we always did a really good job of that.
And I believe, like, Danny's one of the pioneers to want to be one of the first big pop stars that would do GAY.
Yeah, I mean, she's the original ally.
Yeah. You
know, we talk about queer allyship now, in a much more mainstream way, but she, you know, was the first major recording artist to ever perform in a UK gay club like that when everyone was telling her not to.
Well, let's go from our Disco Sister Music to the girl band that she birthed on Popstars Arrivals, Girls Aloud. So, Ian, outside of Xenomania, very rarely have people worked with Girls Aloud, but you and Terry early on, so it looks like, worked with the girls on Girls on Film and Hanging on the Telephone.
Yeah, we did. I mean, to be honest, I think Tel and I have always had a sort of reputation as quite a safe pair of hands for artists who obviously have close relationships with other producers, but are also, so should we say, in the sort of queer pop world. So when it comes, you know, we've always been quite happy to do things like B-sides and additional tracks and remixes and all that other stuff, because I think it's really, you know, I love working with artists who are from that stable particularly and developing relationships with them. And it's been, you know, the same with Girls Aloud. I ended up sort of doing, you know, bits of their sort of live production, bits of, you know, remixes, but, you know, nothing that's ever sort of been a huge, you know, because Xenomania are very much doing this sort of, you know, the mainstream side of it. But, you know, and then I've worked with a few of them individually off the back of that as well. And it's just, they're one of those acts that it's just been nice to be part of that journey and work with them on, you know, particular moments and stay friends with them. I like a phone call. I like to hear something like this.
A conversation that maybe leads into a kiss. It's funny because I was literally looking at my archive in my studio in London the other day. I've got this cupboard because everything used to come on DAT tapes, digital audio tapes back in the day. It was a long dead format. But literally I've got racks and racks and racks of them, which are all of the record company parts from all of these pop artists from that period. So I should send you a picture of it because it's actually like a little time capsule of sort of 1997 to sort of mid 2000s.
Wow.
It's really incredible because he basically used to take the original studio multitracks and then run every track off one by one onto that, and you'd have to stitch them all together.
Oh my gosh, so time consuming.
Yeah, but a lot of fun because you get to hear all of the original parts in a record, yeah. Which as a huge production geek like myself is, you're like, oh, how, you know, what is that bass on? You can't quite pick it out in the kind of stereo mix, but when you hear it, it's on your own, you're like, oh my God, it's that. And it's really interesting because you sort of, in a way, as a producer, you also absorb and learn stuff from other producers and how they put things together. You know, for example, the way that I would have done, put together a Danny track on Girl would have been very different to the way that, you know, the Xenomania Boys would have done it. So it's always quite interesting for me to hear how they, you know, would approach layering their stuff together and how I would do it, because then, you know, I'd have to take it apart to do stuff for live shows and things.
Yeah. And you would hear it differently and you would interpret it differently for, say, like a live performance, you know, which is why when we go to these shows, we're like, oh, we like the live mix of this, or, you know, we like that version. It's like, okay, where do we, that's where we're like, okay, we need the live versions of this on streaming as well.
Well, the thing is, I mean, it stems from, you know, when I was a kid and I used to really love listening to extended mixes of artist tracks, because what they would do is basically to get the original, you know, the seven inch or album version of the multitrack, and they'd loop it,
yeah,
and they'd mute different sections. So you hear, like, you know, on a Pet Shop Boys extended mix, you've got the drums will come in, yeah, which are in the track originally, but then they're on their own, and then you hear the bass come in. And it, so even now my mixes, you know, as anyone will tell you, will still kind of work like that.
Yeah. Now, speaking of live, we had the great pleasure of seeing Lisa Scott Lee's Mighty Hoopla set.
Oh, did you? Yes. Cool. Right, yeah.
God, that was like a very important date.
Did you think we were going to miss that, Ian? Not a chance.
Oh.
So this is something that we as pop fans, and we love Step Saw the Cows Come Home, but we also love those sort of like rarities, and a Lisa Scott Lee solo set in this way is something we never thought we would get again. This set, Ian, you get a call, oh, Lisa's going to do a solo set. What's the approach?
It's the same as any artist, really. You've got key records you're going to be pulling in. The challenge is, for me, technically, with a lot of those older records, you can't get parts for them so much these days. You might have like a simple backing track, or you might. So I remember there being a bit of pulling things together for that. Fascination asked me to do it because they, you know, it's, I mean, it's what I do, really, is, you know, create a sort of banging intro and refresh things, and then, you know, throw a sort of curveball into the work. I think I'm really good at working with artists, and particularly girl artists, encouraging them to try new stuff, and also and listening to them and making sure that they feel super comfortable and excited, but also accomplished when they go on stage. It was a lot of fun to do. And, you know, I've known Lisa for a long time. I think she just really enjoyed it. And hopefully the crowd really liked it. And it was, I really enjoyed it too.
There's no hopefully about it, Ian. It was a highlight of Hoopla for us and for a lot of pop fans. Oh, because
that's good.
It's just, to us, it's such a big deal when something like that happens, and Hoopla is the place that kind of allows it. It's a sort of a place of like, it's us that all kind of felt alone in our bedrooms as pop fans, feeling like we were the only people that loved it. We're then in a sea of audience of people that felt that exact same way growing up. And then to see it in a pop star that's loving it, giving like a career high performance with production that matches that and beyond, is just like, whether you guys realize it or not, is such a gift to us as pop fans. So thank you so much for giving that to us. We want to touch on Sophie Ellis-Bextor, Ian. So another artist that you got to work with over the years, Jolene, again, for the Beautiful People soundtrack. I mean, where's the vinyl reissue of the Beautiful People soundtrack? That's what I'm putting out there. And then also moments, Yes Sir, I Can Boogie, Live It Up. Jolene, 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 please don't take him just because you can. Your beauty is beyond compare, with flaming locks of auburn hair, with ivory skin and eyes of emerald green. How is it working with Sophie?
Sophie's a friend, a long-term friend. I mean, we've known each other, I mean, probably less through doing music together than actually just hanging out at various things. And also, you know, through various TV shows, whatever. We've done a few tracks together. And just recently, actually, we did a co-write with Andy Bell for his record, which is really great. We did that at her house. And, you know, we're just really good friends. And I love her to death. She's just a brilliant, brilliant pop star. You know, she's her own unique talent. She's bright and she's funny and she's charismatic and she's incredibly generous and just brings such a great energy to everything you do. And her husband, Richard, like the most adorable, accommodating people to work with. I mean, I'm lucky that a lot of the artists I've worked with have become friends, really. I think that's one of the things I'm most proud of. And so, you know, every time we see each other, we just have a great laugh.
And I love that, yeah, you worked on Yes Sir, I Can Boogie, which is, I don't know if this happened during lockdown and kitchen disco time, but it is quickly becoming one of her most streamed tracks. And that's,
oh, really?
Oh, yeah, it does very well on streaming. So well done, you.
We did that years and years and years ago. That was like the first time I think I'd ever met her.
Oh, it was a B-side on the B-side, I Won't Change You.
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. I mean, again, you know, with a classic like that, I was always familiar with the title, but I don't really know the original. I know the Sophie version. That is a definitive version.
How can you not
know
the original to that?
I mean,
oh my
but
God.
Once you listen to
that's Gay 101.
You listen to the Baccarat version and then you have vocally Sophie, what she brings to it and your production. I was like, I think I know which one I prefer. No offense to the original.
That's yet another of Peter Durain's fascination's brilliant ideas, because obviously he was A&Ring her at the time. And he was absolutely right. You could just hear her voice singing that song, because she has this sort of British ennui, which is sounds like a tautology, but it's not. She could deliver things in that way, and it just comes across perfectly. You don't have to do much production to get that from her. It's like she just does Sophie, and it's always joyous.
I mean, it's interesting that you say that, Yes Sir, I Can Boogie is, and you put Sophie Ellis-Bextor, you go, I can hear that. When I read Jolene Sophie Ellis-Bextor, I don't necessarily hear that, but the second I hear it, I go, oh my God, this is stunning. Do you recall if that was originally for Beautiful People, or was it something that was in the archive?
Oh no, that was my idea for that, again, because it was me coming up with, you know, going through my Rolodex of people that I wanted to pull into this project that I was working on. It has that melancholy.
Yeah.
That she just can just do in the first take, you know, nail it in one take. That was definitely just another come around to do this for a laugh. And that's what happened.
Fantastic. That's the power of Ian Masterson.
Oh, well, I don't know about that.
He picks up the phone. He sends emails. The minnows come together. Sophie's
on the
track.
It's the people going, get him off the phone. How do we get him off the phone?
Now we have
to
ask.
Oh, God, he's emailed again.
Sophie is working on a new album. I don't know what stage of completion it is. I think it's going to be out this year. Have you worked with her in this era?
No, because, I mean, to be honest, I haven't been doing a lot of pop because of Strictly.
Booked and busy. Start,
and she's been very busy doing a lot of shows. And obviously, you know, she has already has an incredible stable of producers that she works with, and particularly people like Hannah, obviously, as well. So I think she's been off doing that. I think it's something we sort of said, oh, let's do something. And I just, as usual, got too busy doing something else.
Never mind. Next album.
But yeah, yeah, there's always the next one. But I know, you know, Biff's been doing stuff with her and it's amazing. And so I'm sure it will be an absolute triumph, like everything she does.
Amazing. Well, yeah, we can't wait to hear it. But as you kind of said, Ian, You said you like to form these kind of relationships, and even looking at your career, it's really, from a complete outsider that knows nothing, it's really quite apparent that you have built these longstanding relationships, and you clearly are someone that people love to work with. Because, I mean, obviously Danny's the obvious day one of your working life as a music maestro and still to this day, but then one that probably sums it up more than anyone other than Danny is Bananarama. Tell us about your way in with Bananarama. I mean, it seems like you and Bananarama go hand in hand now. Are you arguably the fifth member of Bananarama?
Oh, not the third, the fifth.
Well, you could be the third and the fifth, depending on, because we're very chronological and respectful here, Ian.
Oh, I see. So, yeah, so basically that came about when I was doing a lot of Trials and Enthusiasts stuff. Sarah was looking to do get into writing dance music, top lining stuff.
Oh.
This was when they weren't really doing stuff as Bananarama, I think. Or they'd done stuff and they were taking a break. I don't know, anyway. And so we got together, we got on really well, and we started doing that. And then I think it ended up, I can't remember what happened. Yeah, they were starting to do some stuff together. We just all ended up in the studio. As usual, what happens, you know, we became really good mates and we ended up, well, they're like family, really. They're more than friends.
Mm.
What I find interesting is that I've done more and more stuff with them as time's gone on. You know, originally it was like a couple of tracks on an album, yeah, and then sort of four tracks, and then, you know, and now it's the whole albums, really. I think sometimes, you know, I've heard these from pop fans saying, well, why don't they work with anyone else? Why do they always work with Ian? And in not necessarily a very positive way. It's understandable because, you know, I think if you're a pop fan, you want to see artists, you know, try new and exciting things and not necessarily work with the same people all the time. However, the only thing I can say is it's because the three of us get on so well together, yeah, that it's not work when we work, yeah, together. It's literally, and they are such big pop fans and such big consumers of music and have very strong ideas and bring a lot of ideas to me and sort of push me as well. Mm. We just have such a joyous time making music, and particularly in the last few albums where it's been them releasing their own music. So there's no ridiculous expectation from a record company or, you know, as some idiot A&R person telling them the wrong thing. Or them, you know, basically the whole thing has been, oh, let's write some records. Oh, we think we've got an album. Oh, let's put the album out.
Yeah.
And then lo and behold, you know, the last eight singles we've done have been A-listed on Radio 2.
Yeah.
You know, which for an independent artist,
amazing,
is incredible, you know, and but the most important thing is that we are all very proud of the last few albums that we've done together. And particularly, they would say the same thing, I think. And I don't think there's any better reason for making music, you know, aside from wanting to have some creative voice. It's about making yourself happy.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's made all three of us very happy. And we've got to do some really fun shows and events and things off the back of that. Yeah, but the most important thing is still our friendship. So, you know, we'll keep doing stuff as and when we feel like we want to do it.
And there's no pressure, you know, just for the love and joy of it. I mean, I think you said earlier that, you know, dancing around your bedroom to Bananarama, you would have been a fan from, like,
oh God, yeah, early days.
So What was going through your mind when Sarah reached out, wanted to top line? Were you like, okay, wait a minute, I get to meet them, I get to do stuff with them? Like, what's going through your head then?
I've never been a sort of a pop fan as a fan of the celebrity side of artists, put it that way. I'm a fan of records.
Yeah.
Very much. I'm not, I guess it's not so much about meeting them, it's about the chance to, you know, take their sound and do something myself with it. Mm. That would have been what I'd been thinking about. Yeah, I'm geeky, basically. That's it. I'm less into celebrity, more into the geeky side of it.
We definitely relate to that. And, you know, talking about that journey from the 80s to the kind of 2000s Bananarama, I mean, you worked on Viva, that album. I think Viva came after Drama. So it was already like that kind of introduction of Bananarama to... Well, especially for my generation at that time, that I was really tapped into pop music then. Obviously, I knew the 80s hits, but I was being introduced to kind of dance, Eurodance, pop, Bananarama, and what that would sound like. And you're part of shaping that sound onwards to, you know, now still shaping what that sounds like. How does that kind of conversation about inspirations and where you guys see things headed creatively for Bananarama, how does that kind of conversations happen? And
yeah, I think you're thinking there's a bigger master plan than there is. there's never a plan with me. I think, you know, I'm quite reactive in terms of, I love consuming music, but also I love being bombarded when other people play me stuff.
Yeah.
And they'll quite often come to me and say, oh, we've heard this, I really like this. Or, you know, it could be an old record, it could be a new record or something else. And it's all just kind of, if we throw enough ideas in, quite often they'll start writing something in one style and you'll be like, it's not really working. And then suddenly it'll mutate into something. I'll take it away and have a little brainstorm about it and it'll turn it into something else.
For such like legends like that, you want to be like, you know, our dream for anyone would, you'd want to be in a work situation where the end goal is you're just working with people you enjoy working with every day. And I imagine in pop, as fickle as we know it, you know, we celebrate the pure love of it, but it can be a very fickle world. And I'm sure people wouldn't even give a fraction of the energy and love you can put into it.
Well, I guess I'm not a sort of traditional, one of the sort of current, well, wave of sort of pro pop producers that basically are constantly doing sessions with people. I used to try and do a bit of that, but I learned quite early on, I'm not kind of Max Martin / Merlin / production house kind of person. And there's, you know, some of my closest friends are producers who are pretty much the same, like Biff and, you know, Steve would be the same, probably Barry and Julian. Mm. We like working with artists we feel a really strong connection with, but we can also do our own best thing with. And that very often comes from developing sort of longer relationship with them and having time to make mistakes and try new things and just sometimes chuck a session out and just go out for dinner because the vibe isn't there. And you don't get to do that as part of a sort of the production house / production train process. So I guess I'm much more sort of scattergun. Don't really have much of a master plan. I'm really bad at scheduling things. So
Well, thanks for scheduling the chat. I mean, this has been amazing.
This all kicked off a year ago. So thank you so much. And I mean, look, that's wonderful though. Like the opportunity, that's a luxury of like, you know, that's again, what I was saying, I think an end goal, like instead of like running towards this master plan. Look, we've been running your ear off. Last big thing we want to talk about, you know, all this amazing pop work. You've then conquered television. Drag Race.
Conquered.
We're saying conquered, and it's not up for debate. Drag Race. How did this then come about?
The producer, Bruce McCoy, exec producer, is an absolutely adorable person who also, I think, he also happens to be a Bananarama fan. And there I'm not sure if that was the reason, but they reached out to me. Oh, I think it's also because, oh, I know what it was as well. Because some of the production team who work on Strictly were ending up working on the first season of Drag Race, and one of them recommended me. And Bruce gave me a shot because of the, I think because he knew about Bananarama, something like that. Anyway, So that's how I got involved in doing that, really.
I mean, very different kind of kettle of fish to working with pop stars where that's their main job, you know, writing, recording, making music. You know, you're part of the music challenges in Drag Race as well, right? How do you navigate working with like just different personalities like that is just like so different from the kind of studio environment?
I think it's just like, you know, when we do the recording on set, it's no different from reading. It's effectively they're filming a studio session. Obviously, you're much shorter space of time to connect with them.
Yeah.
But you do pick up on their style quite quickly. And I'm not so used to doing it, you know, when they're trying to cram 20 words into a line that can only hold 5. I'm able to go, no, just like
edit,
coach them and edit, do this, and back and forth. And the thing is, what I've noticed is they're all getting so much more professional now because they're so used. The younger ones particularly have grown up in this atmosphere now of watching a lot of professional drag and a lot of, you know, previous performances. And they turn up and they just drop mics, like these drop mic lyrics, like professional. And obviously a lot of it is rap because, you know, I think the minority of queens can sing. And obviously singing in that context is a much harder ask than, you know, some people are always asking, why do they always rap? And it's because literally trying to record 5 sung vocals in 15 minutes each would be pretty much impossible for it to do a broadcast standard performance. But, you know, they turn up and they just slay, for want of a better word. And I sit there open mouthed now and I'm like, yeah, that's great. Next. That's great. Next.
Wow.
It's much less of the kind of, you know, they're so professional and they're so music knowledgeable now as well. Like, I'll give them a reference and they're like, oh, you mean like Charlie? And I'm like, well, yeah, that's exactly what I was going to. And then I remember that, of course, they know that because they're, you know, 25, 30 years younger than me. So.
And then is it a case of when you're showing up, is it a sometimes you're producing a track they've given, sometimes you're bringing a track?
Yeah, so sometimes a guy called Freddie in America writes a lot of the tracks and he's amazing. And, you know, they just send me the track and I will record the vocals and send them to him to do the finished version. And then some of the ones I'm sort of writing one per season now as well. Which is hugely fun. And it's lovely that they trust me to do that. And I've a great time doing it. And I co-write those with Hayley Sanderson, who's one of our singers on Strictly. He's a really good friend of mine. And we've just developed a little niche in doing drag queen pop. So that's really fun.
Yeah, what an amazing niche to tackle. I've done this all my way. We're trainers on the runway. Make every song. I sing now from my throne, the flowers, the star. Get out of the way if you're not here to save in the moment. Well, Ian, you've been really kind. You've given us like way over an hour, so thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
We just want to wrap up with a few quick things. The Most Beautiful Man in New York. You're working with your good friends, Terry Reynolds and Steve Anderson. What can you tell us about this musical extravaganza that you're working on?
What can I tell you? It's probably what you'd expect a musical written by Terry and Steve and me to be.
Dramatic strings, club beats.
It's, you know, I mean, it's something that the three of us, obviously, who are family, really, have been talking about for years. And then about 7 or 8 years ago, I think we actually said, look, we've got to do this. And so we started writing. And in between all our various schedules, we have ring-fenced weeks where we go away and literally work on it.
Yeah.
We finally got it to a stage now where we're ready to show it to people. And so we're starting to do some sort of stage readings of it to again gauge interest from people in the industry. It's fundamentally a show about friendship. It's very funny and very dark and very emotional. I kind of have to see it, I guess. So I really hope that people will be able to see it.
Well, yeah, I mean, so too, yeah, with the three of you working on it, I have absolutely no doubt. And there's one track on streaming at the moment.
Yeah, there's a few up there, I think, on the website already. So, yeah.
Brilliant. And yeah, on Spotify as well. So, yeah, giving us a little taste and then we'll all be clamoring to see it as soon as we can.
Hopefully. Yes. Hopefully.
Yes. Well, we'll keep our eyes and ears peeled for that.
Absolutely.
But Ian, I mean, look, you've achieved so much. Tackle or take on, is there anything you'd still love to achieve, or are you just enjoying it all as it comes?
I guess the next thing that comes along that excites me is what I'll be working on. I should be back on Strictly this year. Just on Drag Race. So those sort of constants are still there at the moment. I've got some secret pop projects.
Ooh,
on the go, dun, dun, dun.
Which are what I should probably be doing the rest of this week. And then we shall see what happens.
Amazing. Well, anyone that listens to this podcast knows that my secret dream is to do Dancing with the Stars Australia. You got any tips for me, Ian, when one day they do call?
I don't know. Get me to do your samba.
Brilliant.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, the opening number needs to be Ride It. Yeah, week one. Da, 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 da,
da, da. With you flying in from the ceiling on a huge cannon.
Oh my gosh. No, it has to be like a banana or something. Whatever the visual was in the video, like Jerry had a big banana.
Oh, of course, yeah. You see, you know.
Well, Ian, this has been absolutely incredible. We can't thank you enough, and thank you so much for your time. And as we alluded to before, like, appreciate it so much. I appreciate this conversation started a long time ago, so thank you for bearing with us and gifting us your time, because an hour and a half is incredible. Where can everyone follow you, Ian?
Oh, I'm terrible at sort of social media stuff generally, but my Instagram handle is at Ian Masterson. So I think, yeah, that's probably the
amazing. And yeah,
not that I'm very good at updating it, I have to say.
Oh, you know, every now and then a little throwback picky with Danny Minogue.
Yeah, look, when you do, and that's all that matters. And then yeah, everyone keep your eyes and ears peeled for updates on the most beautiful man in New York as yes. well. Ian, we can't thank you enough. This has been absolutely incredible. So thank you so
thank
much
you
for chatting with us.
No, it's been great.
Oh, now, literally, now we just need all the extended mix back to back on a playlist. And I'm going to be losing my mind all over again.
Okay, fab. Well, you can do that then, because I can't remember half of them.
We will, don't you worry.
We'll get to work. Send our love to your husband.
Oh, yes. Please do. Big love and thank you to Dan.
He'd be really thrilled.
Okay. Amazing. All right.
Thanks, guys. See you, loves.
That was fabulous. I mean, the memories.
Well, pop fans, hope you loved this as much as we did. Big thank you to Ian again, and thank you for creating this incredible music. If you are loving what we're doing, please do leave us a lovely 5-star review. Hit that subscribe button. Tell a pop loving friend. Follow us at Right Back Pod on all social media platforms. Email our hearts rightbackpod@gmail.com. You can follow me at Dr_Joel B. That's Dr_Joel B. And you can follow him at
Love Limmy.
Until next time, you're a DJ, we're a song. Bye.
I actually thought you were going to end with A tout à l'heure, mon amour.
You're the bilingual one, darling.